Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Nancy Ellen Abrams, an author, musician, and activist engaged in the role of science in shaping a new politics. As a lawyer and Fulbright scholar, she has worked for the International Heretical Association in Rome, a European environmental law think tank, as well as the Ford Foundation and the Office of Technology Assessment within the U.S. Congress. She also co-created the technique of scientific mediation, a process that allows government agencies to make informed and insightful policy decisions on issues where science is crucial but disputed. She has consulted on the use of this novel procedure for Sweden, the state governments of California and Wisconsin, and Exxon Nuclear. Ms. Abrams has penned several books, including The View from the Center of the Universe, The New Universe and the Human Future, and most recently, A God That Could Be Real, Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet. The first two of those books mentioned were co-authored with her husband, Joel Premack, an astrophysicist most recently at UC Santa Cruz and a pioneer in the study of dark matter and energy. Nancy graduated from the University of Chicago with a degree in the History and Philosophy of Science and earned a JD from the University of Michigan Law School. Nancy, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be a really cool investigation today and interview because in addition to my obvious interest in the social scientific study of religion, I've always had this fascination with astronomy, cosmology, and physics. So a really big treat today to be talking with somebody who is addressing the intersection of all these worlds. So in many ways, this is a personal indulgence of mine. So I'll just invite the listeners to kind of listen along. I was also excited to receive a copy of your book as you have the distinct honor of having a couple forewords written by two amazing individuals, Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa and astrophysicist Paul Davies. And that latter guy, Paul Davies, happens to be one of my favorite science writers. So a big time congratulations on capturing the attention of those folks. I mean, wow, how'd you get them?
Well, I was very fortunate that Archbishop Tutu actually really liked my book, even though, of course, from a religious point of view, we do not see eye to eye. But he really appreciated the fact that I opened up a whole new way of thinking about God in light of modern science. And he is actually very interested in science. Paul Davies is, as you mentioned, not just a great science writer, but he is actually a leading astrophysicist. And it was very important to me to have a foreword both from the religious side and from the scientific side to make the point that my book is really coherent. It shows us, I think, for the first time, a way of thinking about God that is absolutely scientifically rigorous, but also spiritually useful.
Yeah, the book really does do this. And I want to recommend folks to it. It's a book that I found a lot that resonated with me and also a lot that I struggled with. And again, the title of the book is A God That Could Be Real, Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet from Beacon Press. We'll link to it on our website. You know, my initial thought when I picked up this book that it was going to be this nice encapsulation of the typical science versus religion debate that's gone on for some time. But as I dug into it, I found it to be really an autobiographical tale of somebody's intellectual and spiritual journey through life. So that was also a great treat to have. And it prompted me to approach this podcast interview a little bit different than other ones we've done in the past. We always do explore the background of our guests to discover how they arrived at studying the topics that they do examine. But I think here I want to dip a little bit more into that autobiography because I think your worldview is really intertwined with that. Let's figure out how you got to where you are. Let's start with your own personal background. And you note in your book and elsewhere that you started out as an atheist. Tell us about this journey from atheism to discovering God.
I was an atheist even as a small child, and my parents and nevertheless sent me to Sunday school to get some kind of a religious education. 8 years I suffered through that, and it was extremely confusing to me because I couldn't figure out whether the grown-ups really believed the stuff they were teaching us or whether they were trying to trick us, because it was clear to me that it wasn't true, that these things couldn't have happened. And the fact is, either way, whether they were trying to trick us or they really believed it, either way was very disturbing to me. So that was a problem for me in my childhood, to understand why did grown-ups believe these things? What was going on?
Now, did your parents believe this stuff? Were your parents practicing?
My parents did not, but my grandparents were extremely Orthodox, and so were many of my relatives. My parents were not, because my parents are Jewish, and they, my mother's entire family had just been murdered by the Nazis, the ones that were left in Europe. So my mother just completely rejected religion. And my father was also a soldier in that war. He saw what happened, and he rejected it too, but their parents never did. And neither did many of my relatives. So it was confusing, I must say, growing up that way.
Yeah, and then they just ship you out to religious school because, what are they hoping?
For social reasons.
Oh, okay. Hey, all the kids are doing it, so let's go.
Totally social. In fact, when I was much older, not that long ago, I remember asking my father, why did you send me to this, why didn't you find a temple that where I could really learn something with a great rabbi, or why did you send me to this place that really was just a social center? And my father said, they're all the same. Basically, he really didn't think there was anything to be learned in religion. He just felt that I needed to have a place in my society.
Yeah. Okay. So, and this is when you're pretty young, and you're pretty precocious here to be questioning that. I mean, most of us, you know, I remember being shipped off to Sunday school, and, you know, we heard about Jonah and the whale. And so I said, okay, Jonah and the whale, got it. You know, when's recess? What's going on inside your head, and how does this transform throughout high school?
Well, what happened basically, I never could believe these crazy stories. And when I would ask the teacher, I would always get an evasion as to whether they even believed it. When I was 15 years old, I went through the confirmation process, you know, this big ceremony where your whole class gets confirmed. And 2 weeks before the confirmation, the rabbi assigned us to write an essay on our belief in God. And so I wrote, honestly, that I thought God was a fiction invented by weak, comfort-seeking humans. And so before the confirmation ceremony, he took me into his studio, and he shut the door, and he yelled at me. He just yelled at me, who do you think you are to challenge the wisdom of your ancestors? Over and over again, he said that. And you know, I always tell people he did confirm me that day in atheism.
Yeah, that was not a winning
strategy. I'd
have
been agnostic before that, but yeah. I was an atheist from that day on.
Okay, yeah, that wasn't a winning strategy.
That was the most idiotic strategy ever with a kid. Anyway, so it lasted. Really, I probably would have been an atheist for the rest of my life, except that about 27 years ago now, I found myself in a 12-step program because I had an eating disorder. And an eating disorder, it's just like an addiction. It's a kind of an addiction. And I could not stop. I would just go into this mindless eating. I could not stop. And dieting didn't help. So I joined this 12-step program, and these programs are based on the spiritual idea that if you're addicted to anything, it could be chocolate, it could be shopping, it could be alcohol or heroin, no matter what you're addicted to, the whole nature of addiction is you can't stop on your own. But the theory is, with the help of a higher power, however you define higher power, however you do it, you can recover. So this was an enormous motivation for me. I was very excited to find this out, but at the same time I thought, this can't work for me. There's no way I'm going to trick myself into believing in some kind of a higher power. That's not going to happen. So, but lots of people are like me. And so they tell us, well, just act as if you have a higher power. So that forced me to imagine, well, what if I had a higher power? What would it be doing or saying? And I discovered that just imagining a higher power and allowing it to think for me, so to speak, made a huge difference in my behavior. And I realized I was starting to think of the higher power as a loving but unbullshittable witness to my own thoughts. Now, I don't know if you know anything about addiction, but we bullshit ourselves all the time. Oh, I'll never do this again. I'll never touch that again. And, you know, 5 minutes later, we're doing it again. That is something that my witness could never, never have allowed. My witness was basically me, or at least at that point it was, at my absolute best without any of that, the con game that I would be playing on myself. The point is that by imagining that I had a higher power, even though I didn't believe there was anything out there, my behavior changed. And over years, and for years I didn't believe in God at all, but I still was able to recover a lot. I mean, my whole life changed in absolutely wonderful, in wonderful ways. And I could not understand what is going on here. I'm talking to something I don't believe exists, and that is changing my life. What is happening? Meanwhile, at the same time, I was learning about the whole evolution of the universe because of my husband's research in astrophysics, and particularly in cosmology, which is the study of the universe as a whole, as a single evolving being. And I was learning about the real universe, and I was thinking about higher power at the same time. And that really was the genesis of my discovery, trying to reconcile these two threads of my life was really my great privilege.
Now, this must be really interesting to be married to an astrophysicist, because I don't know, you're probably pretty good at math. I'm not. So it would be kind of a scary world for me. But to be injected into this really high-powered world of really smart scientists and stuff, and then to start to be thinking about God and higher beings, how did that work its way through? I mean, did your husband go, what are you thinking of? You know, dark matter, energy, here's an equation, or what?
No. Okay. Because we actually never use mathematics. The whole point of the course that we invented a course at the University of California, which we taught for 10 years, where we tried to explain how the way that people look at the universe affects how everything else in their culture develops. Let me just step back a little bit and say that fortunately, I have a very good background in physics, not because I study physics, but because I study the history and philosophy of science. So I actually study physics historically, and that means starting in ancient Greece with Thales and the Aristotelians and so forth through the Middle Ages. I studied how pictures of how the universe worked arose and how they fell. So I have a very good understanding of the history of science and also of how science really operates. It's not a bunch of facts. It's not a vocabulary the way that they sadly teach it to kids in school. It's so terrible how they teach science as a bunch of vocabulary words, as if science is just facts that have all been discovered. It's not that at all. It's a whole attitude toward learning and toward reality. Anyway, I had fortunately studied that, and so I had enough background to start really following what my husband was doing when he got into this business. And I was, yeah, he included me. I went to the conferences. I used to pay attention to what was going on, who was, what team was working on, what aspects of the theory, and we invented this course where we tried to understand how historically a new picture of the universe changed the culture, because we knew that this new picture, based on dark matter and dark energy as the fundamental forces of the universe, this new picture will be the picture of the universe of the future, because it's right to the extent that it's known. It's not fully understood, of course, but to the extent that it's known, there's a tremendous amount of data, and at this point, this is right. So this is going to be a whole new picture of the universe. It's going to change our culture just the way the Copernican Revolution changed medieval culture and led into the Enlightenment.
Yeah, and I think you're,
hope this one leads to an Enlightenment too.
Yeah, and I think you're the person who's right at this intersection, having the history of science background and earning a degree in that, and then being right in the midst of very exciting discoveries in dark matter, quantum physics, and all of this stuff. It's must just be absolutely fascinating. Now, you mentioned that you and your husband put a course together. You see, and then you got into writing books. How did you get into writing a book specifically that encapsulated some of these spiritual ideas in it? Was your husband resistant to this? Were other colleagues?
No, but you see, our first two books, well, the two books that we wrote together are really not spiritual books.
Okay, okay.
They are, but people have interpreted them that way. You're not the only one.
Yeah.
I got hundreds of letters, literally hundreds of emails from readers in response to the view from the center of the universe, that many of which said, this is spiritually what I have always been looking for. And yet we never even talked about that. We didn't talk about God. It was not a spiritual book. What it was a book about how we humans fit into the universe, how we can now have a coherent picture of how, and not just ourselves personally, but how the evolution of our entire species fits into the story of our universe. And that is, of course, a spiritual experience for people. The way I like to define spirituality is that it's about our experience of connecting to the universe that we believe exists. That means that if you believe that a little tiny universe that a God just said exists and it came into existence, if you believe that that exists, then your spirituality is going to be limited to your connection to that tiny universe. It will be connected to whatever universe you believe exists. So the more that you understand the universe, the larger your picture of reality, the more enormous your spiritual experiences can be.
Does this lead you then, and I'm curious, you get the emails, the book is just, you know, here's how we view the universe and here's how this affects culture, and then all of a sudden the emails start pouring in about spirituality. Is that what prompted you or pushed you in the direction of saying, okay, you know, I'm going to write a book that is called A God That Could Be Real?
No, not at all.
Huh?
Because really when I was writing The View from the Center of the Universe, I was still in my stage in my recovery in the 12-step program where I really didn't have any concept of God.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a funny thing happened. Our editor, when we handed in the manuscript, our editor said, but what about God? You haven't talked about God. And we said, this is not a book about God. This is a book about science and how we fit into the universe. And he said, if you don't write something about God, I'm not going to publish this book.
Mm-hmm.
And we were shocked.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I said, all right, I'll write something. And I wrote one page that was completely vacuous. And he said, okay.
Check the box.
And that was it. I mean, it was ridiculous. I'm still kind of embarrassed by that one page, but I had to write it to satisfy our editor. Anyway, the point was that that was back in 2006 that book came out, and I still hadn't figured out how to think about God. Then, I remember it was actually on a specific day in 2008 that this incredible idea came to me that there is a way to think about God. See, the thing is, I'm only interested in God if it's real. I'm not interested in a fantasy God. I'm only interested in it if it's real. But if it's real, then I think it may be extremely important. So what occurred to me on this rather amazing day was I should stop asking, does God exist? That's a ridiculous, pointless question. You can never answer that. The real question is, could anything actually exist in reality, as we now understand it, that would be worthy of the name God? Completely eliminate the question of existence. We start from what's real, and we ask, what is worthy of the name? What does the name mean to us? What do we need it to mean? And from that moment, I understood exactly how to think about it. It just came to me all at once. I realized that if God is real, if it's something in this universe, it can only have emerged from human beings. It has to be an emergent phenomenon from us. And then I thought, but what aspect of us? Because the way we trade goods, from that, what has emerged is the economy. From trying to get each other to live a decent, you know, treat each other in a decent way and so forth, governments have emerged. These are emergent phenomena. They are real, they are powerful, they govern our lives, but they're not human, even though they're entirely created by humans and entirely dependent on humans. They're collective creations. Now, creations isn't even a good word, because the whole idea of emergence is not that we create these things. Nobody created the economy. It arises through the laws of nature. It really arises through complexity, because complexity creates newness. So I thought, well, what aspect of us could possibly have created or possibly have emerged as God? And I realized there's only one thing, our aspirations, because God is an aspirational ideal. So if you think of all of humanity's aspirations interacting, what will emerge on a higher level is God. Or it's an emergent phenomenon that we can call God. And we should call God, because it's the most godlike thing that could possibly exist. So that was my thought, and it came to me all at once. But then, and I thought, oh, I have to write this. But then we got this invitation from Yale University to give the Terry Lectures there, and that's a very prestigious series of lectures you give over several weeks, and then it's turned into a book by Yale University Press. So by the time we ended up writing the lectures and giving the lectures and turning them into a book, a couple more years had gone by, and then I finally got around to writing this book.
Yeah, I have to ask about that day. You said that a very specific day in 2008. Was there anything different about this? I mean, the obvious question that you're going to say no to was there a glowing figure that came down and pointed a finger? Okay, yeah, that would get. But I mean.
This wasn't something that was what somebody else would call a spiritual experience. This was kind of an intellectual realization.
Mm. Yeah.
It was an intellectual realization, though, that had a lot to do with how to think about my spiritual experience, because I have had a spiritual experience ever since I started thinking about my connection to the universe. Because as I said before, a spiritual experience for me means experiencing my connection to the universe I believe exists. And the more that I learned about what exists, the more intense and exciting my spiritual experience was becoming. So I was primed for this. I was really thinking about God a lot, wondering how can we use this concept. I have to say that I know that you're interested in the response of other scientists to my idea. And I want to say that, to my surprise, all of the scientists I've spoken to have been extremely positive and want to know more and want to talk about this. The only people who have really just come out and said this is a bunch of crap are atheists. Not atheist scientists necessarily, but some of the atheist blogs that that reviewed my book after it originally came out. I remember one of them said, "Who does she think she is to redefine God? God is supernatural." the big expert on God is this atheist. So my whole point is that God does not have to be supernatural. We don't have to buy into that. But we don't need to throw out the concept of God just because other people have defined it as supernatural and we don't buy that version of it. Because the idea of God is so deep in human evolution. It's a word that every person on this planet over the age of maybe two or three has heard and thinks they know what it means. It's so deep in us it could even be hardwired. You can't just throw out an idea like that. You have to rescue it. We need the power of this idea. And the only reason I know we need the power of it is that I saw how my life changed before and after. Before, when I thought that word had no power and was just, ridiculous, my life did not work well. There were things that worked well, aspects of it, but all in all, I was not really happy. I was incredibly self-critical. I didn't understand my own potential. I judged other people. I blamed things on other people that were not their fault. I mean, there were a lot of things I was just doing wrong. And since I really came to this kind of an understanding of a God that makes sense to me, and even before that, even when I was just pretending, when I was acting as if there's a God, I changed. I became much happier, much easier to get along with. I think bigger. My eating habits changed totally. I haven't had an eating disorder in 20-something years. I mean, it's really astonishing how my life changed. And that power, which, as they say in the program, the power to do what I could not do alone, is accessible to everybody who wants it. You don't have to buy into some old-fashioned version of God. You just have to open your mind to the possibility that God could mean something to you, and then look for what it means to you. So that was really, that was a big change in my life, that I saw that transformation in myself at the same time that I was intellectually understanding the world, and I needed to bring them together.
Yeah, I have to back up that day you had that feeling, and you mentioned that you tell this to other scientists, and they get it. And because I've had that as well, too, you know, even though I'm only a social scientist here, I teach economics to students. And, you know, I look back on my life and say, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s, I kind of got the econ. I kind of would parrot it. I could tell it from the book. But there's a period in my early 40s, I all of a sudden it just, you know, woke up and you're like, oh, now this all makes sense. It just seems to be interconnected with everything. It becomes part of the fiber of your body, your thinking, and everything that you do. So yeah, that feeling, it's hard to describe, but I think I know what you're talking about here.
Good.
You mentioned human evolution, and that's one of the really interesting aspects of your book that you talk about here, and it's one that gets us to this issue of the new cosmology or the quantum physics and dark matter stuff and how we're going to reshape the universe and if we're on the kind of a verge of a big paradigm shift here. But I want you to back up here and talk to us. You have a couple chapters in the book about the evolving nature of God and how you see that informing the relationship between science and spirituality. So go ahead and tell us what you mean by all of that.
The evolving nature of God is just a historical reality. In the beginning of the idea of God, gods, well, there were multiple ones, gods represented the forces of nature. And these forces of nature were not understood in any deeper way. There would be a god of a mountain, of a river, of pottery, even, all sorts of things. And the way that people used this concept of gods was to relate to the forces of nature. It wasn't supposed to be an explanation of what was going on out there in some objective way, the way that we think of science as trying to explain what's going on out there. The mythology of these gods was a set of stories that included the person telling the story or their origin. So it was really about how do we connect? And there never was just an instant jump to monotheism. That didn't just happen. That happened very slowly. The early Hebrews did not just buy into monotheism, not at all. There was a long period of time when they wanted the same thing from their god that all the other gods of the peoples around them had. That is, the other gods had earned their place by fighting some great war with the forces of chaos and had come out triumphant. So here were these poor Hebrews being told, oh no, your god just was. He just was. Mm. And then he said, let there be, and there was. Well, that was not easy to buy into. And in my book, I even quote a number of passages from the Bible that show that this was a really difficult thing for people to accept. And in fact, a lot of the Bible Maybe I can even find one of those. Oh, yeah, look, here. Here are some quotes from the Bible. Thou didst divide the sea by thy might. Thou didst break the heads of the dragons on the waters. Thou didst crush the heads of Leviathan. Thou dost rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, thou stillest them. I mean, these are references, really, to the pagan stories of gods who beat the earlier forces of chaos, especially the god of Babylon, Marduk, who actually, there was a huge influence of Babylon on the Bible, because the Jews had been exiled to Babylon for two or three generations and had just been allowed to return to the land of Israel when the Bible was being put together. So they were very much influenced by having grown up and, as I said, several generations in Babylon. So the way that the Babylonian god had beaten the forces of chaos, that was a big part of these Hebrews' story, and they wanted it in there. So what I'm saying is that monotheism was a slow evolution. Eventually, it did win out. But what didn't change from paganism to monotheism, what never changed was the picture of the universe. It was always a flat earth with a bubble of air or space over it, a hard thing in the shape of a dome, whether it was a goddess's body or a hard thing that was actually built by a monotheistic god. That was what held up the waters, the cosmic waters. And above and below this little three-part world was just the primeval water, endless water. That was the picture of the universe. And it was exactly the same in the pagan world and in the monotheistic world. So the change to monotheism did not really give them a new universe.
But science does progress, and it starts to change the way we look at things. So tell us what is happening, and how is that affecting our relationship or our understanding of God?
Well, science is giving us a picture of reality that we have a lot more faith in than any of the earlier pictures, because now we actually know what evidence is and how much evidence there is and how to evaluate the evidence. We know what we can believe, what we can use as best working knowledge, and what we can use as our best guesses, but we need to work harder on. I mean, there are all those different levels of understanding, and science has given us that. We certainly are not in a position where we really couldn't tell the difference between science and religion anymore. In the ancient world, there really was no distinction between the physical world and the world of the gods. There was no distinction. The Egyptians believed that the waters of the Nile came from the spiritual world and just ran right into Egypt. I mean, there was simply no distinction. We don't have that anymore. We know what the physical world is, but we don't know what the meaning of the physical world is. That changes all the time, depending on our outlook. And that's where spirituality comes in. How we interpret this astonishing universe that we live in is really open. And that's what's going to be changing drastically in the future as people start to understand that we are not living in the universe we were taught we were living in. When I grew up, I was taught that we live on an average planet of an average star in a universe where one place is no different from any other. And that's completely wrong. Turns out, we are not living on an average planet at all. Our planet is absolutely extraordinary, not just compared to the other planets in our solar system, but compared to more than 3,000 extra solar planets that have already been discovered, and more being discovered every day. Our planet is different from all of them. Our solar system is extremely unusual. Now that so many other solar systems have been discovered, the astronomers are amazed. Our solar system is clean. It has hardly any asteroids and things flying around in it. Every once in a while, yes. But so much, so much less. If there were the usual number of asteroids flying around here, it's very unlikely that life could have even evolved. We would have been hit so much. And also, all the planets in our solar system are moving in orbits that are almost completely circular. While in most solar systems, the planets are swinging in on these elliptical orbits really close to the star, coming around really fast and then zooming way out and slowing down, coming way, you know, that kind of an orbit makes it also very difficult for life to evolve because the conditions keep changing. In many, many ways, we are on an extraordinary planet in an extraordinary solar system. And space is not the same wherever you go. It's actually really different. I mean, different things are happening at different distances, and at some point, everything changes.
Yeah, that's the whole world of the quantum world, the very, very micro and the very, very macro becomes really odd in physics. And, and that changes our view of Newtonian physics, because I guess I'm a child of Newtonian physics. That kind of made sense to me. I learned that in high school. Quantum physics is starting to come out when, you know, and getting more traction when I'm going through this, but I didn't understand any of that. And so for me, I'm reading through your book, you know, I'm reading that, okay, we have this, the era that we've lived in for the past, I don't know, a couple centuries, maybe since the Enlightenment, has really been a Newtonian era, and how that, and we understand the world there. It's no longer the intervening gods of way back when, but it's a distant god that, you know, might intervene or might not, and there's debates about that. And then we move into this quantum world, right, which is just utterly strange for anybody who grew up in the Newtonian world. Tell us about this kind of transformation. We're at this, I don't know, a cusp of a big, huge scientific revolution here.
We are in a revolution today that is just as big as the Copernican revolution. It's just that we're at the beginning of it, so people haven't quite caught on yet. But the Copernican revolution really did help end the Middle Ages and begin the Enlightenment. And it gave us our first picture of reality. Reality at that point was limited to the solar system. But it gave us our first picture of reality that was actually based on science, on observation and calculation and data. And that had never happened before. Well, the ancient Greeks, they certainly did some observing, but it was really very different when Newton actually figured out the laws of gravity. Now, Newton was right for the size scale that he was talking about. The solar system really does operate according to Newtonian laws. But that's because Newtonian laws of physics, work in a context where the gravitational field is weak, like it is here on Earth, and nothing moves very fast. And nothing is very large or very small. Basically, Earth-like conditions, sort of middling-sized conditions. But once you start moving into much more extreme conditions, like the gravity near a black hole, which is incredibly intense, or at speeds that are relativistic, that is, speeds that are getting close to the speed of light, once you go into those extremes, the Newtonian equations simply do not work at all. They make no sense. You have to move then into larger theories. So the more modern theory of gravity is Einstein's theory of general relativity. And on very, very small scales, it's the quantum mechanics. The thing is, you have to use these theories. There's simply no way that Newton can explain those things. So you can say Newton makes sense, and of course Newton makes sense, because our intuition is entirely earthbound. So the laws that apply on Earth will indeed be the ones that are built into our intuition. But we have to expand our intuition, and that's what science lets us do. That's the whole point of acquiring new knowledge, to expand our intuition, to expand our sense of connection to this universe. Because if we can't expand our intuition, we won't really believe in our connection to the universe. And so we won't ever really understand it.
So what you also do in this book, and this is the challenging part. Up to this point, I'm like, wow, this is, you know, a fascinating tour de force of history, of science, of our understanding of God. You then move into some waters that really intellectually challenge me. And I'm wrestling with these things. I'm going to admit it here, but and it challenges my Newtonian view of the spiritual world, so to speak. And you talk about God, a God that cannot be real. And I want you to explain this because you have these five criteria that I think are really going to shake some people here, right? That you say that God can't exist before the universe, that God can't create the universe, that God can't know everything, that God can't plan everything. So that's a bummer for the Calvinists. And then that God can't violate the laws of nature. What do you mean by all this?
Well, these are very common notions of God, and certainly not everybody's notions, but these, I think, are the most common notions of God. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to explore what it means to be real. Now, if you want God to be real in your life, but your vision of it or your definition of it requires that God have characteristics that are impossible in the physical universe, then you are making it impossible for that version of God to be real. So what I've done here is I've simply listed those ones that you mentioned. God couldn't have existed before the universe, etc. And I've shown why, scientifically, those can't be the characteristics of a God that's real. So, for example, why couldn't God have existed before the universe? Well, the whole history of the universe tells us that complexity evolves from simpler states of being. So it couldn't have been an intelligence that is complex enough to design anything at all, let alone a universe, before cosmic evolution even began. And it's not even clear where the beginning was. What is the beginning of the universe? Well, we used to think it was the Big Bang. But then, in the, I guess, 70s and 80s, the theory of cosmic inflation laid out what happened right before the Big Bang. What set up the initial conditions for the Big Bang? What injected the irregularities into the Big Bang that ended up evolving into the cosmic web of galaxies as we observe them today? All of that was injected into the universe before the Big Bang, right before the Big Bang. So here we have a theory that goes further back than the Big Bang. And then people say, yeah, but what caused that? What caused cosmic inflation? And now there's another theory that explains where cosmic inflation came from. Now, it's probably a mistake to even ask what happened in the beginning, because that is not a smart way to try to understand the universe. What we really should do is realize that science goes backwards. We learn things backwards. There isn't a beginning and we say, okay, A happened here and then B happened there. We look back and we say, okay, well, there was the Big Bang. Oh, before that, there was cosmic inflation. Oh, before that, there may have been something called eternal inflation. The thing is, we're learning backwards. It's as if we're explorers starting here and now and spreading out in all directions. So to try to say what happened in the beginning or what happened first is just as pointless as trying to say what happens at the end. Where's the final moment of the universe? That doesn't make any sense either. So it doesn't make sense to me to say that there could have been a God before the universe, because we don't even know what we mean by the phrase before the universe. I also say God can't know everything, because there is no set of knowledge. There is no single set of facts about the universe. The fact is, the universe is different from every point of view. Everywhere in the universe, there's redshift data from expanding away galaxies. And on every galaxy, you see the universe completely differently depending on the information that's arriving at you. So there is no unified reality of the universe. And besides, we can't know, no one can know, not even God could know what lies beyond the cosmic horizon, because there's no way for information to travel to us or to any point from there. You can say God is everywhere, but then God wouldn't even know its own self, because there would be no way for information to travel fast enough. So there are things about God that people say that when you really come down to it, they can't actually be true. But that doesn't mean there can't be a God. This is my whole point in this book, that it is lazy, lazy, lazy to say that because God can't be A, B, and C, God therefore doesn't exist. No, A, B, and C are simply mistakes. They're just historical ideas that nowadays we know are just wrong. But we have stated what God can't be. Now it's time to consider what God could be. And that's what my book does. And I explain how God can be just as useful to us, just as close to us, just as easy to talk to, just as powerful in our lives if we think of it as an emerging phenomenon arising from the interaction of our aspirations. It can be just as useful an idea as any other. Give me 1 minute to explain what an emergent phenomenon is, because this is so relevant to my concept of God.
Right. That was my next question. So go ahead.
Yeah. So let me just do it, but with an example rather than explaining didactically. Okay. So ants are very, very simple creatures. Ants, they can just follow scent trails, and they really can't do very much more in terms of communication. They just follow the pheromone trails. And they don't have any understanding of the ant colony. But if you look at 10,000 ants in a colony, the colony has all kinds of sophisticated abilities that none of the ants understand. Colonies can calculate. They can, they send out a certain proportion of the ants to look for food, another depending on how much food is already stored in the nest, depending on how many mouths there are to feed, even depending on whether there are other ant colonies out there competing, where the good sources of food are. Somehow the ants get allocated by the colony, but there's not any ant that understands that. The ants can build an anthill taller than a man, and there's not a single ant engineer or architect. So what is going on? What is a colony? A colony is an emergent phenomenon. And it comes into existence not from the ants directly, but from the complexity of their interactions. This complexity theory is a whole field in science right now. And it turns out that when situations get complex enough, when the parts interacting become complex enough, when you step back and look at the larger picture, something new is arising on a larger size scale. That's the model that I'm using. I'm saying that when human interaction, when the interaction of our aspirations, of our dreams, our hopes, of what we really want, of our driving forces, that aspect of us, when all of that interacts in an entire culture, what arises is an emergent phenomenon. And I'm calling that God. It's real whether you call it God or not. A number of the scientists I've spoken to have said, well, this emergent phenomenon, very interesting, but why do you have to call it God? And you don't have to call it God, but just it seems incredibly smart to call it God, because A, it gives you a really great concept of God, and B, it rescues God from those who would use it to basically beat other people up, cause conflict, manipulate people, and so forth. I think we have to rescue God from those people.
Yeah. That's one of the implications of what you're talking about. I want to get to that in a second here. But to ask questions, I think that many of our listeners would have, those of us kind of stuck here in the Newtonian world of God.
You're not stuck.
I'm not stuck.
Choosing to be stuck.
I'm pretending to be stuck. Okay.
Anybody can step out.
Okay. But here's a couple questions that you ask, and I think you do very well, and it's a very interesting. People will say, well, what about the afterlife then? And what about prayer? I mean, is prayer useless then? Are we praying to an emergent order? Does God hear our prayers? Are there answers? How would you answer those questions?
Well, I pray quite a bit. And you might wonder, well, you know, who am I talking to? Well, I do not believe that the emerging God has a unified consciousness, any more than the economy has a unified consciousness or the government has a unified consciousness. They don't, and yet they do exist, and they're powerful. So for me, prayer, to a great extent, is trying to put myself imaginatively into the universe that I believe exists, to try to feel part of the reality in which an emergent God can come about. So if I, for example, think about how I, here's just a really, really simple example. Suppose you go out on a dark night where you can see the Milky Way. If you look at the Milky Way, what you see is a kind of a swath of white across the sky. The same thing that the ancient Egyptians saw, the same thing that everyone has ever seen for thousands of years. But in the ancient world, they thought it was a river or a road. So they thought it was the Nile in the sky, or the Greeks called it the Milky Way, meaning the Milky Road. But we know that that's not what the galaxy is. We know that the galaxy is a gigantic spiral galaxy, and we are in it. And when we look at the galaxy in the sky, we're seeing a gigantic spiral edge on because we're inside it. So when you look at the galaxy, if instead of just thinking of it as a swipe across the sky, you see it in its three dimensions, you see through it, you look through it, to your eyes it looks the same, but to your mind it's completely different. You're in the real galaxy. You are part of this galaxy. You're in our spiral arm. And you can even think about it, the more you know about it, you can think about it in four dimensions. Because in our galaxy, once you know that the stars are not just going round and round the center, they're going up and down around the center like carousel horses, up and down and up and down, and on different trajectories. Some go very high up, some only go up a little bit above the disk of the galaxy. Once you know that, you can just look at the Milky Way and you can see that. You can see it, and you are now becoming part of the universe in which God can emerge. To me, that's a prayer, even though it's really more like a contemplation. It's a prayer. And also, when I want to be able to do something that I find really hard, I just think about myself as contributing to this amazing planetary phenomenon of God, this planetary phenomenon of something arising from humanity that every one of us is plugged into, every one of us from infancy is part of, is contributing to, is drawing from this phenomenon that is creating the meaning of everything. Because human beings don't create the meaning. We get it from our culture. We get the language from our culture. We get ideas and so on from our culture. That culture is being created by this emergent phenomenon of God. So when I feel myself connected to that, I'm bigger. I feel stronger. My problems look a lot smaller. My power feels larger. I mean, that to me is also a prayer. I never ask for favors. That is not what God is about. God doesn't treat us differently. God can't treat us differently any more than gravity treats us differently. I mean, gravity doesn't distinguish between us. Nevertheless, as I like to say, some people are fabulous acrobats and other people are complete klutzes and cannot walk through a room without knocking something over. But the difference between them isn't gravity. It's how they use it. It's how they think about it. It's how they've trained their minds and their bodies. And that's the same with God. It's there if we train ourselves to see it and understand it and relate to it. And we don't notice it at all if we don't.
What about the afterlife? That's a big, important component for a lot of folks. And having just buried a friend this past weekend, you know, that stuff, the existential stuff of, you know, when does it all end? Does it all end? Come up. How do you address that in your thinking here?
Well, I think the most important thing to ask before we ask what happens to us after we die is, Well, what's the difference between after we die and before we die? What are we before we die? What are we now? I don't mean who are we in the sense of who I am as an individual, but what are we? What is the primal thing that we humans share and participate in while we're alive? What is going on there? And of course, we all have our own individual consciousness. But if we think about ourselves as just an individual, then that particular consciousness that we have can't possibly go on after we die, because it's being generated by the complexity of the neurons in our brains. Consciousness is an emergent phenomenon, too. But that's not what we are. We are far more than that. Each of us is participating in many, many emergent phenomena. Every time you write something, you're changing the language. Every time you may be participating in an industry or an art or a science or education or whatever, the thing is, you're part of many bigger things. And when you take into account all of your roles and how your tentacles really are spreading out throughout the culture, whether you realize it or not, that much bigger identity, that's you, that's the real you, and you are part of the flow of humanity. Humanity isn't just the people on Earth. Humanity is the species evolving. It involves the past and the future as well as the present. And we're part of that. We, everyone who's alive today, is a representative to 21st century Earth of the human species. We are the culmination of everything before us, and we are the hands of the future. Everything that we do is going to affect the future of our species. When we start to understand that that huge identity is what we are, that's the part that can be immortal. That's where the afterlife comes in. And the one thing we know, the only thing we know that's going to happen after death, is that we become ancestors. We become ancestors. And in some cultures, ancestors are honored and revered. And wouldn't we like to be honored in the future? Wouldn't we like to be esteemed ancestors rather than reviled ancestors who basically destroyed the planet? Yes, we would rather be that. And we can be esteemed ancestors, and we can enjoy the pleasure of being esteemed ancestors right now, if whenever we make a decision that's going to affect the future, we ask ourselves, what would esteemed ancestors be doing now? And I believe that every time a law is passed, every time there's a budget that's put together for an organization, every time people make policy decisions, the fundamental question really should be, what would esteemed ancestors be doing now? If we could live up to that standard, the future of our species would be assured. That's the way to think about the afterlife.
This kind of comes, we're running short on time here, but this comes to a concluding question that I have. And as a social scientist of religion, I'm interested in the social organizations that we have now of churches and denominations and all those different kinds of things. Your thought is really putting a challenge to this, and you address some of this at the very end of your book. So let me throw this out there for you to answer. What does the future of quote unquote organized religion look like? And is this starting to change the moral ethos of our society, our global society?
Well, no one knows what the future can look like, but I want to say that I think that the organized religions that don't take into account the universe we actually live in, the scientific world we actually live in, will become smaller and smaller and less important in the future. But if there were any religion at all that accepted science, that welcomed science, that said, what kind of a world are we living in? What kind of a world do we want to see? And how do we get there? That religion would find many adherents in the future. And I think that it's very important to ask, what do we mean by God? cannot buy into the kind of just the traditional notions of God just because they're traditional. God is the ultimate symbol of our aspirations, and we need to tune our aspirations to the world we actually live in and have a symbol, have a God that works for us, a God that can... The only kind of God that can really help us is one that's real. And we are going to need all the help we can get because we are facing, in climate change, a problem that no one has ever faced before, possibly even on any planet. We don't know if any other species has taken over planet to such an extent that they're changing the conditions. So we're facing an enormous, enormous challenge, and we are going to need every advantage we can have. And I think that a strong spiritual background for scientifically oriented people would be an enormous advantage.
That is a really fascinating message, and one that really resonates throughout your book, A God That Could Be Real, Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet. I do recommend this to folks that really need to go through a rethinking or a challenging of their thoughts here. So I want to thank you for writing that book and spending time with us. My guest today has been Nancy Ellen Abrams. Nancy, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, you're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.